Today is Thursday, May 6th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia. A U.S. security official tells VOA that forces carrying out airstrikes against the Taliban in support of Afghan national security forces.
The U.S. is actively carrying out airstrikes, more than one, against Taliban targets in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province.
Plus, what is free speech in the United States? And how one doctor in India is grappling with the surge in cases? We'll have these stories and more next. A U.S. security official tells VOA that forces carried out airstrikes against the Taliban in support of Afghan national security forces. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Sheldon shares the details.
A U.S. official speaking to VOA on condition of anonymity, given the security concerns, the operational security concerns surrounding the withdrawal from Afghanistan, confirmed that the U.S. is actively carrying out airstrikes, more than one, against Taliban targets in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province. Due to the security concerns, they would not elaborate beyond that, although Afghan officials have spoken out saying that these airstrikes are precision airstrikes, and they've told other media outlets that they've been intense and heavy, and in some cases have been the only thing that have stopped Taliban forces from advancing on the city of Lashkargah in that province. So these are things that are ongoing. It is likely that there will be more airstrikes to come. The U.S. has said consistently, and the Pentagon reiterated today, that they will continue to do whatever they can as they withdraw for the U.S. military to support Afghan forces when they need it. Of course, the longer the withdrawal goes on and the more U.S. troops leave, the less likely it is that airstrikes like this will be able to be called in.
Did they mention about what kind of engagement U.S. forces were participating in? Are these drones? Are these aircraft? Because as you mentioned, U.S. forces are in that process of withdrawing from Afghanistan.
Our understanding is that these are aircraft that have been launched from Afghanistan and are carrying out these missions. U.S. officials, though, are not sharing very many details because as these airstrikes are being carried out, you're seeing on social media how both the U.S. and the coalition are pulling forces back and are giving bases over, handing bases over, facilities over to the Afghan security forces. So they're not saying exactly what they are, precisely where they're coming from. But right now, that's our understanding of the situation, and that these strikes are being called in at the request of Afghan officials, who at the same time have been talking a lot and putting out a lot of propaganda, if you will, on social media about how well Afghan forces are doing on the ground, about how well the Afghan Air Force is doing in striking Taliban targets, in striking Al-Qaeda targets on the ground. Of course, some of this in areas where fighting is taking place, this simply cannot be verified. Taliban also are making numerous claims likewise in terms of some of the intense fighting we're seeing, not just in Helmand province, but also in Paktika and also other parts of the country.
Speaking of that intense fighting going on in country, has the Pentagon commented on whether or not any U.S. troops are involved in these Taliban clashes?
U.S. troops are not involved on the ground. One of the things that the Pentagon emphasized again is that for some time it's been the Afghan security forces who have been in the lead in terms of operations on the ground. And the Afghan Ministry of Defense told VOA on Wednesday that all of the planning, the command and control, the execution has really been in their hands, and that it involves no foreign troops, no U.S. forces in terms of whatever action is taking place on the ground, any of the hand-to-hand fighting, the combat, that sort of thing.
Jeff Sheldon is VOA's national security correspondent. The airstrikes came as the United States appeared upbeat about the resumption of stalled peace talks between the warring parties in Afghanistan, even as fighting escalates amid the withdrawal of U.S. and NATO troops from the country. A senior U.S. official on Tuesday said during a background briefing in Kabul that Washington's diplomatic efforts are continuing to try to get the peace process between the Afghan government and the Taliban back on track. But U.S. former ambassador to Afghanistan Ryan Crocker told VOA Diary Service reporter Gila Nouri Withdrawing now could escalate the danger for everyone.
This is a very hard moment for Afghanistan and the Afghan people, clearly. The Taliban have been very transparent, ready to issue whatever statement we want to hear, and very ready to conduct operations of major violence on the ground. We've seen the bombings in Herat, in Kabul, Kandahar, attacks in Helmand. They are telling us exactly what they're going to do. They're going to bring the same bloodshed and death to Afghanistan that they brought in the 1990s. So it's imperative, as Chairman McCaul and I tried to convey in our op-ed this morning, that the administration take steps to mitigate it. There's no going back. You cannot unring this bell. The president's been very clear. We are going all the way out as fast as we can get out. So we need to hear what the administration's strategy is to protect and to move those who have served us at risk of their life, translators and others, thousands of them, that have already had, we've already seen too many killed. More broadly, the situation for females in Afghanistan, girls and women, we encouraged them to step forward, and they did, in education, in business, in the military, in politics. What happens to them, and what are we going to do to mitigate that? And on it goes. Fundamentally, it is the question of America's national security. 9/11 came to us from Afghanistan. The Taliban hosted al-Qaeda, who planned and executed the operation. That alliance is still strong.
So a U.S. senior official says that the Taliban didn't close entirely the option of joining the Istanbul conference, and they're talking about among their leaders to participate. Also, Ambassador Khalilzad spoke to President Ghani and other officials in Afghanistan discussing the peace process, and they also, Ambassador says that if the Taliban reduce violence or also join the peace talks in Doha and attend Istanbul conference, there might be an option of removing all troops in July. How likely it is, and can the Taliban really trust it in this case?
Clearly, the Taliban has its own agenda. It always has. And that agenda is retaking power in Afghanistan by whatever means work.
Taliban increased the attacks since May 1st, and Afghan forces also performed some counterattacks against the Taliban. And the level of the violence, do you think it will impact or extend the troops' stay, or it will impact any change in Biden's decision for Afghanistan for troops withdrawal by September 11?
I don't think that that is going to change anything. The Taliban will continue with these attacks, sadly, not waiting for us to be gone. They know we're going. So what we're seeing now is what we're going to see moving forward. At the same time, though, I don't want to suggest that when the last American soldier is gone, the Taliban will sweep into power in Kabul. It won't go that way. The Afghan security forces will continue to fight very bravely, as they have in the past. They have taken incredible losses, killed and wounded, but they have continued the fight. They will continue the fight, I'm confident, after we leave.
That was Ryan Crocker, a former U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan, speaking to VOA Dari Service reporter Gila Nouri. The Taliban suspended their already troubled peace talks with Kabul representatives in response to the United States' decision to extend their drawdown through September. The so-called intra-Afghan negotiations, which were stemmed from a U.S.-Taliban deal started in Doha last September, have mostly been deadlocked. The Taliban have linked their participation in future peace talks to the release of 7,000 prisoners being held in Afghan government jails and the removal of senior insurgent leaders' names from United Nations and U.S. sanctions lists. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. A U.S. federal judge has ordered the release of legal memorandum the Trump-era Justice Department prepared for then-Attorney General William Barr about former President Donald Trump. The AP's Mike Gracia has the details.
A federal judge has ordered the release of the Trump-era Justice Department legal memorandum prepared for then-Attorney General William Barr prior to announcing his conclusion that President Donald Trump had not obstructed justice during the Russia investigation. The group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington filed a Freedom of Information Act request seeking communications about the obstruction decision. In her order, U.S. District Judge Amy Berman Jackson said the Justice Department obscured the true purpose of the memorandum when it withheld the document. She said the memo from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel contained strategic as opposed to legal advice. The judge gave the Justice Department until May 17th to file any motion to stay her order. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Former President Trump remains banned from Facebook, at least for now. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani is up next.
Facebook suspended Trump's account indefinitely 4 months ago for inciting violence before the Capitol riot. The social media giant's quasi-independent oversight board says it agreed with the suspension, but not with the length.
Indefinite penalties of this sort do not pass the international or American smell test for clarity, consistency, and transparency.
Co-chair Michael McConnell says the board is now giving Facebook 6 months to decide whether to lift the suspension, extend it for a set time, or permanently ban Trump, who also remains suspended by Twitter. Sagar Magani, Washington.
Trump reacted angrily to the oversight panel's decision, saying that free speech had been taken away from him. But what do the U.S. Constitution and the nation's courts say about freedom of speech? For that answer, I spoke with constitutional law professor Joe Paul at the University of California Hastings College of the Law.
Well, I have a right under the Constitution to go to a park or a street corner with permission, with a permit, and I can protest or I can speak my mind freely. I can speak my mind freely to my friends. I can write letters to my member of Congress. I can place ads advertising my opinions. I can contribute to the political candidate of my choice. But no one has the right to protest, say, in the opinion pages of the New York Times. No one has a constitutional right to protest on a broadcast network. Those are privately owned, and so the Constitution only applies when we're talking about government or the government's functions. When we're talking about a public park or a public street, those are public places where I can protest, I can speak my mind freely. It's protected by the First Amendment of the Constitution. The exception to this is if a private actor, like a newspaper or a network, is acting like a state actor, in that case, then the First Amendment would apply. So the question is a social network like Facebook or Twitter, are they a state actor? And there are very few cases on this question. There were some cases in the 1940s and 50s and 60s in which the Supreme Court seemed to suggest that if a private actor is performing a public function, they may be regarded as a state actor. So is a social network more like a public park or is a social network more like a broadcast network? I would argue that the social networks we have give people many different choices of how to express themselves, where to express themselves. It's not like there's just one park or one street corner where you can go demonstrate. And there's no barriers to entry. So if Mr. Trump and his supporters want to start their own social network company, they can certainly do so.
Now, the other thing I wanted to ask you is, what do the courts say is actually protected speech? Because as I understand it, you can't just say anything, anytime, anywhere.
Sure. Well, in one of the earliest cases before the Supreme Court, Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes famously said that a shouting fire in a crowded theater is not protected speech. You don't have a right to incite unlawful action. You don't have a right to libel another person or to slander another person. You don't have a right to threaten someone. You don't have a right to commit fraud or to promote pornography or obscenity. these things can be limited. So we have a distinction between what's protected speech and what's unprotected speech. The kind of speech that Mr. Trump and his supporters are engaged in may be classified as political speech, and in which case it would be highly protected speech. But to the extent that statements are made that are fraudulent, that are intended to mislead people, or that may originate from foreign adversaries like Russia, that are intended to create disinformation and to corrupt our election process, that kind of information would not be protected and could be prohibited outright by the state.
Joe Paul teaches constitutional law at UC Hastings College of the Law in San Francisco, California. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu failed to meet a Wednesday midnight deadline for forming a new government following the March 23rd election. Therefore, Israel's president offered someone else a chance to form a government. Reuters' Soroya Ali has the details.
Israel's president chose Yair Lapid, a centrist politician, and Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's strongest rival, to try to form a new government on Wednesday. But his path to success and whether it could end years of political stalemate in the country was still uncertain. Neither Netanyahu nor his rivals managed to secure a parliamentary majority in the most recent election on March 23rd. It was the country's fourth election since 2019, and all of them were inconclusive. Netanyahu has been fighting to stay at the top while also on trial for corruption charges, which he denies. He had 28 days to put together a coalition, but it ran out overnight into Wednesday after he failed to agree terms with potential right-wing partners. President Reuven Rivlin, in a televised address, announced his choice of Lapid to form a new government. He said the former finance minister had the pledged support of 56 of parliament's 120 members, still short of a majority. Lapid also has 28 days to try to form a coalition.
Soroya Ali reports for Reuters News. The sixth round of U.S. mediated talks between Lebanon and Israel was postponed Wednesday after Beirut rejected preconditions set by U.S. mediators at the talks a day earlier. Reporter George Ade has this update.
After coming to a halt 5 months ago, U.S. mediated negotiations between Lebanon and Israel over their disputed maritime borders resumed Tuesday. U.S. diplomat John Disraeli had broken the fifth round of talks before the Lebanese delegation refused to sit for the sixth round of discussions. Lebanese President Michel Aoun said there should be no preconditions for talks to resolve the two countries' dispute and gave instructions to the negotiating team that talks should not be tied to any preconditions and should rely only on international law that will remain the basis for reaching a fair solution. Previous discussions had stalled after both sides submitted maps that would in effect increase the amount of disputed territory. It is unclear if and when another round of talks will be held, which are currently taking place at the UN peacekeepers base in Nakura. George Aid, Beirut, Lebanon.
This is Science in a Minute.
The recent 2020 emissions gap report from the UN's Environment Program indicated if greenhouse gas emissions continue on its current trajectory, the world is headed for a 3.2 degrees Celsius increase in global warming by the end of the century. New research by scientists led by the University of Massachusetts Amherst suggests under such a drastic scenario, the melting of the Antarctic ice sheet would add between 17 to 21 centimeters of sea level rise by the end of this century and a 1 meter increase by 2300. If the increase in global warming were kept within the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement goal of 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius, the Antarctic ice sheet melt would provide between 6 and 11 centimeters of sea level rise by 2100. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Nigeria's military this week dismissed any possible coup against President Muhammadu Buhari, saying it's unconstitutional and a treasonable offense. Nigeria has seen growing criticism of Buhari over insecurity in the country and calls by some critics for him to step down or for the military to take charge. Timothy Ubizu takes it from here.
The military statement was a response to a televised commentary by prominent Nigerian lawyer Robert Clark, who suggested the country could collapse in coming months unless the military took power. Military spokesperson Onyema Nwachukwu said the military will uphold the country's democracy and warned against plots to overthrow the government. But criticisms of Buhari's administration by civil societies, political and religious groups have grown in recent weeks due to escalating insecurity. Rafael Adebayo, founder of the Free Nigeria Movement, a civil society group, says the government can no longer handle the situation.
Insecurity in the country has affected every other sector of the country. Our economy is in shambles. Education is in tatters. There is no hope whatsoever. People are depressed. The poor are getting poorer. And the presidency has run out of solutions.
President Buhari, a former military general, was elected in 2015 and vowed to subdue jihadist group Boko Haram in Nigeria's northeast, which has killed over 36,000 people and displaced more than 2 million. But 6 years later, things are getting worse. Boko Haram is expanding its enclaves in the northwest of the country, while banditry, kidnappings and communal clashes are on the rise. Ario Dare is the founder of Center for Liberty and Development, another group demanding the president's resignation.
It is our candid view that the president should resign. He is currently incapable of leading this country. His mental capacity has failed him, so also his frail health has failed him.
President Buhari was re-elected for a second term in 2019. Dare says the president is not likely to willfully resign, but predicts security issues will be a major topic in the next polls 2 years from now.
It is important that whoever is going to succeed General Buhari in 2023 will be such a leader who has shown competency and has been able to galvanize the entire country to be on the same page in terms of fostering our unity.
Last week, lawmakers urged the president to declare a state of emergency over the country's security. On Tuesday, Buhari met with his top security chiefs to fashion a way forward. Timothy Ubiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Tension has mounted between the United Kingdom and France amid a dispute over fishing rights following Britain's departure from the European Union. AP correspondent Karen Chamas reports.
French Maritime Minister Annick Girardin warned that France would retaliate after it accused Jersey of stalling in issuing fishing licenses to French boats as agreed in the post-Brexit trade deal. As far as Jersey is concerned, let me remind you, for example, of electricity transportation by undersea cable. So we have the means to do something, and even if we regret doing it, we will do it if we have to. The External Affairs Minister for Jersey, Ian Gorst, said Jersey was refining the licenses according to new rules that recently took effect. Gorst said the threat to cut off electricity seemed a disproportionate retaliation for a few delays. Karen Chamas, London.
As India's healthcare system teeters on the verge of collapse during a brutal second wave of the novel coronavirus, Reuters' Emily Wither shares one doctor's story.
That beep sound is continuously in our head, even while we are sleeping. That beep, 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 that casualty noise, the ICU noise, that continuously goes in our head, in our ears, every time, every day.
Rohan Agarwal is 26 years old. He hasn't even completed his medical training. And yet, at one of India's best hospitals, he is the one deciding who must live and who must die. India's healthcare system is teetering on the verge of collapse. The WHO says India accounted for nearly half of the COVID-19 cases reported worldwide last week. At the Holy Family Hospital in New Delhi, everyone knows there aren't enough beds, oxygen or ventilators to keep everyone who arrives alive. So Agarwal has to choose.
What job we are assigned is what is to be decided by God, whom to be saved, whom not to be saved, and we are not made for that. We are just humans.
Yeah.
And at this point of time, we are being told to do this. So it's really a depressing atmosphere, and I just want a break, an hour or so outside the hospital, so that I can just recollect myself. I can just go out of that atmosphere, because I have to be there for another 24, 28 hours.
The junior doctor takes a break outside. His shifts are 27 hours. He isn't vaccinated and is afraid what will happen if he gets infected. It's unlikely there's a bed for him, even at his own hospital.
We are already using our resources to our best possibility, and we are using everything we have at this moment. From basic level to the top level, everybody is working behind us.
Back at the hospital, conditions are cramped in the emergency room. Patients and relatives crowd every available space, many wearing no protection except for a simple cloth mask. When Agarwal began his shift around 9 a.m., there were four bodies in the area where staff removed their protective equipment. One man was even laying in a storage area surrounded by bins of medical waste. His relative is the one dragging in a new oxygen cylinder.
Hey, Shannon. How are you?
Agarwal began his shift making the rounds of the general COVID wards. Along with a senior colleague, he's responsible for 65 patients and only has a maximum of 3 to 4 minutes for each one. He then heads to the emergency room where he has to decide who gets in and who doesn't. If a patient doesn't need oxygen, then usually they are turned away. For some patients, they've already tried 15 to 20 hospitals. 74-year-old Karuna Vadhera is in critical condition, but there are no free ICU beds. Agarwal tells her nephew she might die at any time, and they need to find a bed in another hospital. Five family members are searching Delhi. No one has found a bed.
Reuters reporter Emily Wither. And in marking World Hand Hygiene Day, the World Health Organization is stressing the importance of good hand hygiene practices in stopping the spread of deadly infections. It says this is especially true at a time when the world is battling the coronavirus, which causes the COVID-19 disease. Lisa Schlein rounds things out.
COVID-19 has dramatically amplified the importance of hand washing. The head of WHO's Infection Prevention and Control, Benedetta Allegranzi, says this simple action can prevent the risk of transmitting the infection when used as part of a comprehensive package of public health measures.
Effective hand hygiene also prevents any infection acquired in healthcare, the spread of antimicrobial resistance, and other emerging health threats. Hand hygiene is a simple action that has a central role in contributing to quality care and to the whole of society efforts to prevent infection spread and saves lives.
A WHO survey of 88 countries finds low and middle income countries have made significantly lower progress than high income countries in implementing hand hygiene and infection prevention programs. The report notes one in four healthcare facilities in poorer countries does not have basic water services, and one in three lacks hand hygiene supplies. Allegranzi says the poorer countries lack the money needed to shore up their crumbling healthcare infrastructure. Consequently, she notes, most do not meet the minimal requirements to make a significant dent in reducing often life-threatening infections.
For example, in some low middle income countries, only 1 in 10 health workers practices proper hand hygiene while caring for patients at high risk of healthcare associated infections in intensive care units. While also in high income countries, hand hygiene compliance rarely exceeds 60 to 70%.
WHO reports every year healthcare-acquired infections affect millions of patients and health workers globally. Europe alone, it says, records nearly 9 million infections yearly. The UN agency says highly effective and low-cost hand hygiene strategies are available that could reduce these infections by half. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And for VOA's International Edition, I'm Steve Miller in Alexandria, Virginia.